I know that many of you have different kinds of interests. I think the staff kind of had in mind, too, that we would probably try to put this in some kind of a context as far as Christian unity is concerned, and we'll deal just, you know, very briefly with that, not only because of the lack of time, but the lack of information by the one who's presenting. But I'd be interested just in out of curiosity, you know, what kind of representation we have. Holden is one of the few places where we have, you know, a good representation from all types of Lutherans, and I think that's helpful. Well, I know it's helpful. I'm wondering, are there some LCA, Lutheran Church in America, people here? Few, you betcha. How about Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? There are a few. Oh, that's the way it always works. I'm sorry. Good, that's great.
How about all Lutheran?
All Lutheran? Are you pan-Lutheran? You are.
For all three. All
that's
four.
Right, you do. Well, that's one of the neat things about Olden. It's still surviving as a pan-Lutheran based enterprise, and I think we can all rejoice about that a great deal. Well, where I come from also, I claim that probably we have a finer ecumenical relationship that goes beyond talk of any place I know in the country. I could spell that out for you, but I just assert it because I know I'm coming with certain biases, because we have a wide spectrum. We include now the Southern Baptist representative just came back from the mission field, who's very gung-ho ecumenical, also very concerned about the social issues of our time, and a very progressive Roman Catholic bishop who is dearly loved in our community, who I think by dint of his reputation was able to bring the Pope out to the Holy Father out to Des Moines. So we have a wide spectrum, and the forces of unity are strong. I'm convinced of that. I think that's the first thing we have to say. Now, there are many kinds of unity types that are going on, and maybe just a quick overview of some of those might be helpful for us as a context for Lutheran unity. The World Council of Churches, in its Faith and Order Commission, which has been the major factor, I think, in the World Council. We hear a lot of other things about the World Council that are very disturbing to many folk, but I don't think that is. And because the Lutherans are so dominant in the World Council, you know, they are much bigger than all the rest of them put together, except for the Orthodox, which joined relatively recently, they have been a very dominant force in doctrinal emphasis, so that the doctrine is not just missed. I sat next to one of the district presidents way back in many years ago at the World Council Assembly in New Delhi, where I was a delegate along with himself, and he was very opposed to the World Council of Churches. By the time we had finished our meeting, we had gotten stacks of papers, you might guess, as part of the church, like this. I'm not kidding, it was like that. And we had to somehow bundle those up or throw them away or burn them or whatever. A lot of them got burned. There was a lot of smoke around there for New Delhi for a long time. But the interesting thing was he leaned over to me kind of on the last day and said, going back to a district that was quite opposed to the World Council, saying, you know, I read through all of this paper, he said, and I haven't found one word of heresy in any of it. Now, you wouldn't believe that, except that the fact that Lutherans just insist that there's going to be a biblical theological base to everything that's said. And that's very carefully done. Now, the interesting thing is that Bill Lazarus, who's an LCA member, a very prominent LCA member, who is working in this whole field now for the World Council, has been given credit for designing a statement that has come up. I have not seen the statement. I've written all over for it. I've seen a lot of releases and a lot of reviews of it, called, I believe, the Word, the Church, and the Ministry. And for many enthusiasts, it is the place where maybe a new shape of doctrinal base has been formulated that really has been a breakthrough for many people. As I say, I haven't looked at it, and I take other people's word for it, but I think that's significant, that a new kind of a foundation has been laid for and it's a doctrinal foundation rather than some other kind. Then, of course, in this country, there has been the so-called COCO Union that's been going on for more than 20 years now. It consists of, well, most of the major line churches, standard brand churches, other than the Baptists and the Lutherans and the Pentecostals. It's a wide-ranging group of churches, church bodies that have been wrestling with very difficult thing at forming an organic union, not just a kind of a federation or where you keep your own identities intact, but a real union. The Commission on Church Unity, as it's called, started by Bishop Pike and several others way back in the early 60s. They just came out, for instance, last year with a statement on the ministry again. Very interesting. That's getting a lot of attention by a lot of different denominational groups. And really, it's surprisingly a healthy kind of a document, to my mind at least. It would be hard to match that with our confessions very closely, but there are some elements to it that are very strong. And what has happened in my mind in the last 30 years, you know, anybody that was for kind of an ecumenical approach to life 30 years ago was called an ecumeniac. I mean, it was just, that was all you were. And what that meant was you were trying to get all of these church bodies together now under one roof, and John 17 dictated that everybody had to be the same, you know, and all of that kind of business. Well, what we could not, in terms of humankind, propose, God disposed, and I think what has happened is that we have found most major line denominations going back to the scriptures, to a lot of their confessional base, in a way that's very exciting, so that you can meet people now who 20 years ago were flaming liberals who hardly even looked at the Bible as being important, now who really, really take that scripture seriously. And I think that's something which the Holy Spirit has done for the church. While it hasn't brought organic union any faster, and I'm not so sure that's really what we're after, it has brought a kind of a theological and doctrinal union, that unity that is really quite apparent. Now, those are kind of multi-flowing streams in these forces of unity that are going on in the church, both worldwide and in the United States. There have been, however, several bilateral conversations going on, usually called dialogues, and I think it's fair to say that in almost every case, the Lutherans have been the initiators and early initiators of these dialogues, starting with the Roman Catholic Lutheran dialogue that has gone much farther than I think it's fair to say almost any theologian, at least in our circles, felt it could go at this point, dealing with some very critical factors like the sacraments and the like. Another very interesting one, I find it the most fascinating one because it's so untoward in some ways and so unexpected, is what has happened over here, the Episcopal Lutheran dialogues, which Dr. Norman Nagel has been a part of that dialoguing. I think you were from the beginning, were you, Norm? Mm-hmm. Back in, what, 72 or 71 when it started? And what is amazing is that the first volume that came out from that group that worked so hard on that dialogue, coming together, knowing very little about each other, culturally and sociologically, we're two different churches, we just plain are. But they came together, one building its whole understanding of the faith around worship and the Book of Common Prayer and the like, and we building a very strong base on the scriptures and on doctrinal statement and all the rest. And then when they came together, finding that there was very little that could distinguish them in most things. There are some sticklers like apostolic succession, but even there they worked at that. And I remember reading the preface with some amazement of that little book, which is written by the Episcopalian that's probably best known in this country, Reginald Fuller, in which he makes the bold statement, I think this is correct, that we came together not believing that we could even come close to anything that meant anything, finding that we were much closer together than we realized, even on critical doctrines. And now we would ask the question, what is going to prevent us from organic union? Now, up to that point then, there has not been much said about it. Our church authorities did not give much credence to this, didn't pay much attention to it, frankly. I suppose mainly because of some of our sociological differences, as much as anything. And then when the second round began, as I understand it, Norm, two or three of our, probably the LCA, walked out of the thing saying, if this wasn't going to be a serious understanding by the church authorities, that we are, what we are doing here, we do not want to have a part in it. I only hear rumors about that, but is that essentially correct? Or and so now the LCA and the ALC will, for instance, this fall at their conventions, vote on a kind of selected limited altar and pulpit fellowship, in our terminology, of union, which in many people's eyes is hardly known and is kind of incredible because, of course, the Episcopal Church has been a part of the COCO union, which we have had no part in and have no had no interest in, and that's kind of the way things go. Now, there have been all kinds of others. The Presbyterians, the Lutherans, of course, are quite close in many ways. The Methodist Lutherans have been dialoguing for a while. They came up, and I don't know how many of you have seen a little statement they came up on baptism. I consider it a gem. It's no great, powerful theological statement. It's just a simple, direct statement about what we understand baptism to be, and even some of the practice of baptism. And the Methodist bishop, who's quite outstanding in our state, just newly installed in Iowa, came from Minnesota and is really a theologian. We sat down together one lunch and talked about this remarkable little document, which one of our church bodies had very few that really signed it. They decided not to do that for their own reasons. But out of it, we started some pilots around the state and said, let's get some congregations of the Methodist Church and the Lutheran Church. Let's not just talk about it and pie in the sky with theologians, but let's talk about it right down here. And out of that has come a little study document that I think is just excellent. It was kind of formulated by one of our Lutheran pastors mostly, but several pilots contributed to that. Now we're going to try to get churches in Iowa of the United Methodist Church and the Lutheran churches to do more dialogue on the basis of this study. Well, the Baptists and the Lutherans have started dialoguing also. There are just a number of these kind of bilateral affairs going on, and that's, I think, we should consider that encouraging, that at least Christians are talking with one another and finding maybe that their biblical foundation is stronger than many dared to believe only a very few years ago. To make one other whopping generalization, I think we have to say that the dynamics of Christian unity has changed profoundly also in another way in the last few years. And probably I would say that in at least in Christendom, we don't really have a liberal conservative continuum as we used to have it. There are all kinds of surprises all over the place when you try to delineate things along that line. I think the continuum is much more along what has been referred to here several times this week as the theology of triumphalism or glory and the theology of the cross. And I think you'll find there a much, a better understanding of the divisions within denominations and within segments of Christendom, maybe even emerging a little clearer than the so-called liberal orthodox division. Well, just to look at a little bit then at the Lutheran talks, and there are many here that I know have had much exposure to this, and we won't spend a lot of time in history or anything. We are now in what is called the Lutheran Council of the USA, LCUSA, which the three denominational bodies, the big ones, are a part of in one form or another, not in all parts, but in one form or another. And that's been a very useful thing because it's at least carried on the dialogue in times when things have been pretty tense in the last 10 years. And LCUSA has served a very real purpose. Of course, it does a lot of service kind of things, Lutheran World Relief, Lutheran World Service, and its attachment to the Lutheran World Federation and the like. The thing that is interesting to me, and I think it is part of the historical perspective that we have to have, when the American Lutheran Church that was formed in 1960, and the Lutheran Church in America formed about a year later, when they were at trying to devise what would be their doctrinal statement, what would be the forms of their church life and all that, the ALC had two bodies that were about the same size, the old Evangelical Lutheran Church and the old American Lutheran Church. And because of that, it was very awkward. You know, they just couldn't, they did things differently. They had Scandinavian, German rootage that were different, cultural difference, all the rest, and some organizational differences. And when they came together, they found that it took them 10 or 11 years to compromise to the point where I would say, and I make a quick judgment, would say what they did finally was they got rid of some of the worst elements of both churches, really, and they got some of the better elements of both churches and compromised it into a new church that I think was probably the most carefully studied church body that has ever, in Lutheran circles in North America, has ever been done. Now, in the LCA merger, that was quite a different proposition. There was the Augustana Synod and the Suomi Synod, quite a bit smaller than the old United Lutheran Church in America. And so when they came together, it was not nearly as intricate, not nearly as complex. And they did what the ULCA has done all the way back in its history to the Ministerium of Pennsylvania, way back in the very early history of establishment of Lutheranism in this country. They really kind of just absorbed a lot of churches. Now, some would maybe object to that sweeping generalization, but all I'm trying to say is they did not have to face the kind of compromise, the kind of hard-nosed discussions, the kinds of moments of truth, which almost, in the ALC terms, caused them to back off and say, no, we aren't going to do it. It's too far. Something of the same thing is happening, as I understand it, in the discussions up in Canada between the Lutherans up there, where they are now 5 years behind their timetable for joining for union, and many are getting quite discouraged because of it. But it's still coming, and so we hope that it'll continue to do that. Now, in the merger of the American Lutheran Church, then those two big church bodies were at it, but they had a buffer zone. They had what was called the old UELC, of Danish rootage, which served an extremely useful purpose in that time, and had become the kind of compromise middle position thing that was needed there. In this new union, in the new church that's talked about, we again have two big church bodies, roughly comparable in size. LCA is a little bigger than the ALC, but we have a small group called the AELC, which I think could be very instrumental in bringing about a lot of those kind of compromises, much greater than of influence than its size would dictate. It's even much smaller proportionally than the old UELC was in ALC merger, but it could be a very important bridge in the whole business. So without going into all kinds of details, there has been a groundswell of interest and commitment to this merger in surprising terms. When I started talking about this several years ago in Iowa, the Iowa Synod president myself did a barnstorming tour around Iowa, a kind of a road show, and we were trying to present the case for Lutheran merger. We both believed in it very strongly. And I heard our ALC pastors and sometimes laypersons, although they wouldn't always come to the meetings, get up and say, hey, you know, we don't want to be bothered with this. We're doing just fine. Don't bother us with all that kind of rigmarole. It doesn't affect us anyway. Whereas the LCA pastors, one after the other, would get up and say, hey, we can't wait till this thing gets going. We think it's important. After that kind of discussion went on for about an hour, and I got frustrated and angry, then my colleague Paul Werger in the LCA Synod would get up and say, hey, folks, if you ALC people don't think you need us, I'm here to tell you that we need you. And it got awful quiet in there. and finally then I think there was a lot more interest, and there's been building some interest. It's more true, I think, out here in the West Coast as far as interest in the union than in the Midwest, perhaps. We're so very small on the East Coast that it's another kind of a problem, really, because we're spread out so much over there. Well, let me just briefly say where we are then. We are now going to come up. We've already committed ourselves to merger in the three church bodies that are looking at this. We are going to say, however, in September, in concurrent conventions, at meeting at different places, that we're going to agree on a process for merger. Now, the process consists of many things, but basically it consists of saying from the fall of 1982 to the summer of 1984, when the other church bodies and the ALC will also have their next conventions, we expect these kinds of things to happen. We expect that a doctrinal statement comparable to what we've drawn up in past mergers, that was true of the LCA and the ALC also, we expect that to be drawn up. Now, there's a lot of, or not a lot, but there's some thorny issues there that are going to trouble a lot of people. And that's one thing that has to be done. Another thing that we mentioned the other night was a list of ecclesial principles, as they're called, churchly principles, which has never been drawn up in the history of American Lutheranism, really. And not only that, but very few people are even, well, theologians at least, I think, are very few of them are interested in that kind of thing. We get almost no help from the confessions on it. Then the third document that has to be drawn up by the summer of 84 is one that's called the shape of the new church, which will be kind of an organizational structure. And the person that has been delegated to be the coordinator for all of this, Arnold Michelson, who's presently the General Secretary of the American Lutheran Church, has said that he'd like to see that to be a, you know, a 3/4-inch book with a lot of stuff in there. And so we're asking in less than 2 years what it took the American Lutheran Church 11 years to even come close to doing, and the old LCA about 5 or 6 years to do a similar thing. We're asking that to be done in 2 years with a much bigger union at stake. And then, as you know, then there's some other things that'll follow that, and then we're supposed to be ready to join in January 1 of 1988. I think there are a lot of people who look upon that as a very unrealistic and really almost counterproductive kind of a schedule, because I think what's going to happen is what's happening in the Canadian church is that we're going to come down to 1984 very disappointed about how little has been accomplished, and then say, well, is it really worth it? I met for a week with the Lutheran Church in America bishops at a meeting that was for something else, but our district happened to be invited in on it. And I was surprised at how many of them told me, yeah, we've been gung-ho for the merger, but we had no idea that there were so many problems. You know, we'd never faced those problems in firmer mergers. We just never had to. And now we see all these little sticklers that are going to have to be attacked, and we're not so sure that this is always such a gung-ho idea as we had originally thought of it to be. Now, that's for what it's worth. I think there are a lot of people that are asking that question. We've had about 3 meetings between the district presidents of the LCA and the ALC and the AELC, and I think every time that we've met, we've come up with more problems than we thought were there in the first place. So I don't know that it's going to go so terribly well. Now I'll just go frank out with some of my biases that say, and what my worry is, and I think it's a worry of a lot of people who have dealt with this merger question for quite a while and who have been very committed to it, and have, unlike much of the church leadership in the ALC, which has not been committed to it, I think a lot of us have said, you know, if we can't have now a new church body that has some new breezes blowing in it, that doesn't follow the pattern, for instance, which we have now for several years in church organization, followed simply the model of American industry. There's nothing wrong with that model for American industry, but it isn't necessarily the model for the church. What is even more unsettling, however, is that American industry has been, you know, changing its model radically in the last 20, 25 years, and we are building upon a model that's easily 30 years old. And if we go ahead and just rearrange a few boxes in the superstructure and say, well, we've got our church meeting now, I think a lot of people are going to be hugely disappointed. For that reason, I have some biases, and I'll throw them out just simply to get some discussion going, if nothing else, and then we can throw it open. I think, you know, as a first principle, and maybe these are more ecclesial principles than anything else, is that we're going to have to be a mission-centered church. Somebody was talking in Elmer Witt's session today about the fact that Scandinavians and Germans have not been great about being able to meet the society. One of the great things that happened in the old Ministerium of Pennsylvania, according to many historians, was that they did recognize early on that they were a part of this American scene. It was more than the fact that they were somehow more liberal than the people that settled in the Midwest. It was quite different from that. But the problem has been that we've been very content. And I suppose nothing angers me more than coming into a community now, and I do again and again in Iowa, where it's all Norwegian or it's all Danish or it's all German, or at least that rootage is still there, you and the coast don't have to face quite that as much. And now in these little towns 30 miles from Waterloo and Cedar Rapids and Des Moines, the people have found they couldn't buy a house in those towns. So people with Russian names and Serbian names and Irish names and English names are coming and living in these little towns, refurbishing a little house that's run down. They're willing to pay the extra mileage on gas just because they can save so much on the house. And they're moving in. The last census shows that a great deal of that is taking place in Iowa, much more in the future, as we understand demographers to tell us anyway. But the problem has been, of course, that they don't happen to speak Norwegian. And that's just about as the worst thing you can say about a newcomer if they do come in, if they haven't lived there 20 years. No, I'm only kidding. There are a lot of places where that is not happening, where people are recognizing for the first time. They thought for 15 years now that church is going to die. Little church of 200 baptized members. That it was going to die. Suddenly there are new people all around them. What's going on here? And we've had fine leadership by the church council, and they're beginning to take those people in. We have got a real hang-up. In Midwest, North Midwest Lutheranism, we are in a Northern European ghetto, and unless we face the fact that we are that, and that it is a cultural, sociological thing, has nothing to do with doctrine, has nothing to do with the Lordship of Christ, and certainly has nothing to do with the mission of Christ, the church, we have got to begin to face that fact. And one of the great things that I think is a matter here, that if the ALC, for instance, would join the LCA, I think we would have a much better mission strategy. The LCA has always done better on this than we have done in this country and overseas, for that matter. And I think we could develop a mission strategy. I think the first principle is for this whole business. Moltmann, who wrote a little book on the Church and the Holy Spirit, has made this telling statement. Let's be done with talking about the church has a mission. The church either is a mission or it isn't the church. Now, I had some profs back in my day who used to argue a little bit, kind of mildly, but they used to argue about, is the church fellowship or is the church witness? Or is the church fellowship and witness? Most of them came out there. No, Moltmann says, let's be done with that. Let's say the church is either mission or it isn't the church. And I think we are in peril in the Lutheran Church in America, in North America, of losing our soul. I really do. I think we are in big trouble at that point. I think this new church is going to have to be a lay-dominated church. And I know I can get in trouble there, but I just think we've gone too far. The unfinished Reformation is still what Luther and Calvin firmly believed, and it was not just a lot of icing on the cake. It was central to their whole doctrinal position, and that is the whole point of the universal priesthood, or of the calling of every single baptized Christian. I think there is another model that's beginning to develop among other communions, and we are trying it in Iowa for what it's worth. You've already started it in California, and it's already shown up, I should say, South Pacific ALC. It's called the cluster model. And I think the new church is going to have to look at the cluster model type of organization, where you gather 8 to 10 congregations into a center, and you begin to work your mission program and your program out of that. Or anybody that 8 congregations in a particular area cannot do that a conference of 60 congregations like we have in Iowa could not do. In fact, it'll do it better. We have clusters now that are inviting the highest priced people in the United States, people outside of our communion who don't care how much they charge for their services, coming in to serve 8 congregations, and they've gotten their heads together and they figured out a way to do that. There isn't anything, I don't think, that 10 congregations can do that they can't do better than 50 or 60 congregations or 100 congregations, like in a district, or 400 in Iowa, can do and not do it better. I think that's a model that is says grassroots to me. I think it begins to say a lot of things that are important. I think another element to the whole ecclesiastical, what I like to call, and we are asking Bob Bertram from Seminex to come into our ecumenical circle next fall to talk about a phrase that they picked up from me called ecclesiology for the modern world. And man, when our executive director for our interchurch forum called Bertram on the phone and said, that's the topic, he said, I don't even care when you're having it. He says, I'll be there. He said, I'm just that interested in that topic. I think it's the burning topic right now of the day. And another element to that to me would be to use the same format again, decentrally organized. I think the most brilliant organizational scheme that came out of both unions in 1661 was what was called the regional plan. We had seven regions in the ALC, for instance. It was the most personal way in which work in the church has been done. Since reorganization took place both in the LCA and the ALC in early 70, and took place in the Episcopal Church and in the Methodist Church and the Presbyterian, everybody decided they were going to reorganize in early 70s, and they reorganized in such a way that they centralized everything, and I claim that they centralized Minneapolis right out of the parishes. That's what happened there. We were going to have to go back to some kind of decentralization. I would say even on that score that maybe everything that we do in mission, and that should not be world mission and American mission, that should be one mission office, can maybe be done in one central place. I think almost everything else could be done on a regional level in terms of program. The other thing that I think we have to say is that we're still going to be congregationally oriented. If we aren't that, I don't think we'll get very far in this merger, at least from the ALC side. And then I think we'll also come to a new doctrinal integration, I think, in ways that maybe we haven't done before. Well, those are just a little background, both ecumenically, a little background in terms of what's happening in the Lutheran circles. I'm sorry to say I obviously didn't say anything about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I don't know where that is. If history tells us anything, it'll be three generations before the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod will even talk to the rest of the Lutherans seriously. So it is a serious break, and I don't know what you do about that. I think there are many people that have prayed about it and are very saddened by it all. But it is a fact of life, and I think it's true that if the other Lutherans are going to get together, they are not going to be able to wait for Missouri. That just isn't in the cards. So, what do you say to all of that? Goodness. Yes?
You mentioned grassroots. I remember seeing an article of a survey of all three church bodies among the, I think basically lay people, there may be clergy involved, about do you support Lutheran unity and what's your opinion about it?
Yeah.
And I can't remember the figures, but it seems like the grassroots survey was overwhelmingly in favor of a Lutheran merger.
Yeah.
You indicated some cautions and some concerns by people up here about it.
Okay.
Are they listening to the grassroots? Are they hearing this call for merger, and are they going to try to do something about it, maybe even more than they normally would because of the strong swell?
I think it's fair to say that the leadership in the ALC at least got a message, a very clear message.
I remember that.
For instance, our president, David Preuss, and I did a debate at Wartburg College, or Wartburg Seminary, on this whole question, and they videotaped it, and I don't know, there are copies roaming around all over the United States now. I don't know how they got them, they're bootleg copies. but we tried to draw the issues, but you know, since that time, of course, Bishop Preuss has changed his mind completely. He said he'll work very diligently for this. I think the leadership, whether it's the church structures or doctrine or other things, you know, people in leadership positions tend to see all the stumbling blocks, while the so-called grassroots. No, better than 70%, you see, came out both in the LCA and the ALC, much to the surprise of the leadership, especially in the ALC. Now that was the first time that was done in history, where they had a grassroots vote in all the districts and all the synods, the 33 synods plus of LCA, the 20 or the 19 synods or districts in the ALC and the AALC too, and there they asked them to mark down certain things. You know, what are you for and what are you against? And it was overwhelming. And they didn't have any. You know, it was all done by secret ballot by computer, so there was no reason for. Yeah.
Huh? As a campus pastor, an interesting observation of the years when students have come out of all of these congregations, I would assume would be fairly representative of the grassroots. And one of the standard procedures that I used to ask, and I learned better than I ask it now, when I meet a new student, is about their home church and the, you know, what I'm used to when the Missouri ALC had separate campus ministers, I kind of had to ask the question, supposedly, of what kind of Lutheran are you? And about 90% of those would answer, I'm St. John's, St. Paul's, First Lutheran. They had no concept of a national affiliation. And those few who did were almost exclusively Missouri Synod. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, says something about the grassroots attitude towards a, quote, national church body. They really, most people don't seem to really identify that. They could care less. They're Lutheran and wonder why in the world those people off up wherever that is are worried and concerned about it.
Well, I think our Lutheran Book of Worship has made a big impact on, and will continue. Now, this little, I was telling you about some clusters in Iowa. We had a little cluster, all rural churches, eight churches that asked the leading light of the Episcopal Church in liturgics, Westerhoff, to come out also in education and stuff, but in liturgics. And he made the bold statement there that all of the liturgical people in all the mainstream church bodies have now a firm agreement on all elements of the liturgy and how that ought to be manifest. Now, that doesn't mean that it's hitting the books, you know, anywhere close or will be soon. But the point being that we're not going to have to walk into strange worship services wherever we go. And certainly that's true in the Roman Catholic tradition, more true than the rest of the Protestants for us right now. I don't think it's fair to say that we have much doctrinal difference. Not if you look at the seminaries that represent us. There is a Stickler adjective that's used, you know, to describe the scriptures, which will upset a great many people. A word that really came into use rather recently, the word describing scriptures as inerrant. Marty and others say that it's like it's a no-win term. It's like using the term incomprehensible for Charlie Mays. No. What's the word I'm searching for? The Pope speaking ex cathedra is infallible. When you start applying infallible and inerrant, you know, there's no way out. Now, I'm fully assured that that will not appear in the documents of the new church, and that's going to upset some people. But, you know, you could go into some other things too, but that's not... Well, there's plenty of other people here. They got plenty of opinions about it. I think the great questions are polity questions, so-called organizational questions. Just to mention one or two, the LCA has a polity that goes way back to their ministerium of saying the church body consists of the ministers and the congregations. That means ministers, you know, can attend all conventions and all the rest of it then. The ALC is very clear about that. We consist of the congregations of the American Lutheran Church. That's what our church body is. Now, that's a, you know, there's a lot of implications to that, and you could spend a lot of time arguing that. Joe Sittler, who's the sage of the LCA, says, marvelous. We've had that albatross around our neck for so long, it'd be just joyful to get rid of it so that we can go back to congregational polity of some time. I'd say the LCA also has a little stronger relationship to its synod, I mean, what we call a district in the ALC. There's certainly more authority there. Boy, is there more authority there. Yeah.
Are you referring to the call process when you say that? I heard that from our bishop as one of the...
Lots of things. Yeah. That's one of them where it manifests. But there are a lot of places where it manifests. But that's... you know, there's some health in congregational polity, and we can't give that all up, you know, either. I think the way they've organized the colleges and seminaries is quite different. The organization LCA is on a regional basis, where the colleges are supported by a certain number of synods in a particular place. Seminary is the same way. In the ALC, it's a national relationship. And there are some people that'll go to the mat on that, you know. There are other kinds of differences. Maybe some others can contribute to them. There's plenty of polity differences or organizational differences. Structurally, since the reorganization, we're almost exactly the same. In fact, they had hoped Kent Knutson's great dream would be that it would have been the same for LC and ALC, would even name the same things, but that didn't happen. I'd have trouble with that. Ever since reorganization, we streamlined the ALC just like the LCA did. Now, the other side of it is, and you can argue from a historical perspective, that the LCA had much more independence in its synod, in its synods, than the districts of the ALC ever were. Along comes a man by the name of Franklin Clark Fry, and he kind of turns that around by sheer dint of his powerful personality, not really by pulling in lines, you know, all over the place. That happened in early 70, where there was more of that done. But the synods were quite autonomous, thank you, you know. At least the top, my wife came out of the Maryland Synod, and man, she didn't know that there was an LCA, ULCA around, you know. I think it's fair to say that we are both about as centrally organized right now. As far as grassroots support, you may have more feisty ALC people than ALCA, but that's because a lot of them are Norwegian. And can't do much about that. Yeah.
It seems to me that decentralization is a really key thing.
Amen, brother. I'm with you. I really am.
Especially when you look at...
I have been talking about it for a long time because I feel like this is the structure in the old ALC that did the most good, if you want to really talk about delivery of right kind of goods. What we had going then was a dialogue between the regions and the national all the time, saying, hey, you know, the national is not hitting things at all. Now, I sit in a very peculiar sense. I was in the national office for quite a few years. I've sat in the parish a couple of times, and now I'm in a district office. And I would have to say, you know, and I say it without equivocation, I know more about what the current 400 congregations in Iowa are thinking about and what they want in programming and a lot of different things than Minneapolis will ever know. That is not to denigrate Minneapolis. They're doing some excellent things, and we do dialogue. But I do think if we want to take seriously where people are now, sociologists and anthropologists are saying, in spite of mass communication, we still are probably seven distinct areas in the country that are, you know, the mores, patterns are just a little different. And I hope we could reflect that at least.
I think people are going to need that.
I think so too. Otherwise, you know, just to have a massive organic union up on top there, you know, people are going to be very oppressed by that, as I think they have been oppressed the last 10 years in both denominations. And I don't think the AELC is going to allow that to happen. You know, they're not very keen about it. Okay.
It occurs to me that any church, Christian church, whether it be just the local or in any large group, and that our main emphasis is to reach the unchurched.
Yeah.
And so often, in my experience of being with unchurched people, and I happen to mention that I'm a Lutheran, they seem to know that there are so many different Lutheran churches. Why do you have to have so many? So it always seemed to me that if we would unify like this, that we would give a better image to the unchurched.
Well, that would be my fondest wish out of this. Now, I don't think there's any guarantee of that. I think you can just rearrange some boxes and make us less mission-minded than we ever were before. So I think that has to be fought at, and, you know, that has to be hammered at, as every structure that you perform has got to be, not to pin us in, not to make us more German or more, you know, Scandinavian, but to, you know, to put us out. The reason I say that, and just in terms of a strategy in America, I have great hopes that right now the Lutheran Church stands, and Ron might want to speak to this and others too, that we stand at a threshold of making a witness, for instance, in the South that would be very profound. I have some pastor friends in Texas who, every one of them I think I've talked to, have said, you know, 85% of mine are mostly former Baptists, 80 to 85%. He says they've come into the Lutheran Church. I call them the born-again Christians, because they are so thrilled that they are in the Lutheran Church with a new sense of the grace of Jesus Christ and the freedom of the gospel. They're like new people, you know, and they've been under the law too long. They just don't want that anymore. Now I say we've got a chance there to bring people that are you know, tired of living under the law. You know, many of them have left the organized church long ago. And I think if we had a mission strategy for the South right now, as we're trying to get together, we don't have any money to do it, as usual. If we could get that thing together, I really think that could be a very exciting new chapter to be written for North American Lutherans. And I, you know, that's one phase of it, but there's much more. As you say, we often speak with forked tongue because we often sit with three different varieties of Lutheran churches in a community, and nobody knows, you know, which one is which. You know, what difference does it make? Yeah, right.
I don't know. I'm one of those. I was not raised with. You've heard of people who would say by the Baptist. I was one of them saved from the Baptist.
Hallelujah.
You said it very well. The Lutheran Church presents a very, very viable alternative, at least in Texas culture, with that whole law and the whole kind of lifestyle and philosophy that the Baptists present, the Lutheran gospel, if you put it that one way, it is very fresh and very appealing if they hear it.
Yeah, I'm not saying that to put the Baptist church down, although it sure sounds that way. I'm only saying that we get so defensive about being Lutherans, you know, because we're frozen-mouthed and we don't have any concern about other people's spiritual life and all that. But, oh, you know, we just don't realize what it means to be able to have people sit under preaching of the law and the gospel as it is never preached, I don't think, in any other communion that I know of, as clearly and as purely. I think of, I don't know how many of you are from North Dakota, but there's a little program called Lutherans on the Prairie. That's a television program that covers the four main stations in North Dakota. It has a listener audience twice that all the rest of the electronic media put together on Sunday has. And what they do is they go into these little teeny congregations way out in the sticks in North Dakota, you know, supposedly the sticks. I was born there, so I'm not putting it down. But, you know, here they come in and they maybe tune in on part of the pastor's sermons, or they go and interview some people, and they do it very technically proficiently. And that's just absolutely fascinating to people. They can't believe that out in Camden, North Dakota, they got a preacher that is as good as any one of those electronic preachers in the world. If you want to talk about content, you want to talk about law and gospel, you want to talk about communicating the faith and not some kind of success story, it's a thrilling thing. And I think we've been too defensive and too... Well, I suppose if we went to the doctor, the Lutheran Church went to the doctor, we'd say we're suffering from an inferiority complex. And what he'd probably tell us is, no, you aren't. You are inferior. but I think the whole feeling of being defensive has been part of our tradition way too much. Oh, yeah. That's very interesting. I should have mentioned that. There is a commission of 70 for the new church, 70 people, called the Commission for the New Church, and they are to represent equal number. You know, this is how gracious we become as the preachers of the church. We now let at least half of them to be lay people. Half of them are women. High percentage, or at least a comparable percentage to the number not in our churches but in the society, are to be minority people, and so forth. There's a lot of breakdown. Now, some people are very nervous about that because it'll mean people that have come in that don't have a lot of knowledge about church structures and church politics and all of that. I have great hopes that the Holy Spirit has been doing his work in this process. We just came out of a meeting in when was it, May or whatever, where that was done in a preliminary way, and now we'll approve that or not approve it at our church convention in September. I would say, you know, it was done very carefully, and it was a nightmare to get all these different people represented from the different districts, you know, so that every district had representation, all the other things that were part of it. Campus ministry had that representation, every element of the church. I think it was fairly done. I didn't think so at the time, because I wasn't a member. But no, I really think it was quite fairly done, and for instance, they only chose one bishop, which maybe is healthy. Huh?
They.
Well, that was the church council. And I think it's fair to say the church council did that work. It was the nominating committee did an awful lot of preliminary work. The districts all submitted 6 names of people, you know, various backgrounds so that they could do some choosing. It was not an easy task. And the LCA is finding the same thing, of course. The problem, of course, when you get 70 people together who will have 2 years to do all that work that I talked about, what they will probably have is 3 meetings, each about 5 days in length at a retreat center somewhere. And proposals will be given to them, and they will interact about that. I hope they're not intimidated. I hope they can be, say, you know, at one point or another, hey, this proposal looks like it's off the wall. It's way too tight. We'd like to see the Holy Spirit have much more of a place in this new church structure. We're not buying that. I think that'll happen. I may be, you know, looking at that through rose-colored glasses, but I think there's enough feeling in the church today that we're just not going to buy into the old structures and do things the same old way we've always done them. And I think there's some concerns, like the mission concern, that's very keen in people that care about the church. I don't know. That's, yes?
One of the things I'm excited about and looking forward to is this document on the ecclesial principles and just the explicit setting down of some ecclesiology. Heretofore, it's not been express enough, and I don't even understand. Could you kind of give us some topics that might be covered under this general term?
If they have good sense, they will say it ought to be mission-centered, it ought to be lay-dominated, it ought to be cluster-organized, it ought to be decentralized-organized. In other words, it talks about the structures of the church, huh?
Some of that's polity also.
Yeah, that you know, polity is a nice ecclesial word for structure, huh? And the way we do things. And presumably, you do that out of theological, you know, underpinnings and support. But we, as you rightly said earlier, we have never done that, not to my knowledge, and I don't know of anything that's extant that really gets at that question. I said it earlier, I can't wait to hear Bob Bertram because he's so doggone interested in this. Now, I don't know of any other theologian in the ALC circles. I say I've asked a good many of them who even cares about this. But you see, my theory is that structures are not all that important, but structures can do one of two things. They either can tie you into knots or they can free you up. And if we are concerned about freeing the church up to be mission, then I think we ought to be pretty concerned about ecclesial principles. You know? That's pretty fuzzy. You know, a lot more is involved than that. Norm, you maybe would want to make a comment about that whole thing. It is exciting, I think. I've been living in structures for a long time, both mostly, or many of it, much of it secular. And I hear, I work for an outfit called the Freedom from Hunger Foundation, totally secular outfit in Washington, D.C. And yet the central driving concern of the people on that board were how can we set up structures that will free us to do the work that we're supposed to do. That I don't hear the church saying much about.